We are talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And fingers crossed this week that we won't have the technical issues we had last week. We apologize for that. That actually wasn't any of our faults, for once.
And it wasn't because they were tearing University Temple down, because we're not there. Oh.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, that happened this week. Just in one day, they knocked the whole building down yesterday. So
R.I.P.
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
Our old home is gone.
Our old home is gone, and the home of numerous homeless support services that served both the U District and the greater Seattle area, which most, I think, found new digs elsewhere. But, boy, what a friggin' disaster for those organizations. So.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And adding that on top of the pandemic was not fun.
No.
No.
No, it was not a good year for... Yeah. It was good up until, you know, until the end. But, boy, the ending was somewhat brutal. So, enough about that. Let's move on to other brutal news this week. Election-related news.
Yeah.
Keeps getting
we've got a primary coming up in, like, a little over a month.
Yeah. Now, this week, Prison Legal News reported that Deputy Mayor Casey Sixkiller, who is running for mayor, has a history of working on behalf of private prison companies, oil and gas firms, and gun manufacturers in his Washington, D.C.-based lobbying firm, Sixkiller Consulting. Now, before he formed his own firm, he worked for McBee Strategic Consulting from 2006 to 2010, about a 4 to 5 year period. And he represented Corrections Corporation of America, which has since changed its name to CoreCivic. It's the largest private prison company in the United States.
It had to change its name as a rebranding because it had such a terrible reputation.
Yeah, and some of its facilities, now run by CoreCivic, are immigration detention centers. And it has a record of defrauding the U.S. government, not hiring enough staff at its facilities, and doing little to stem the violence at its prisons. McBee has lobbied the federal government for years to promote harsh treatment of immigrants and to keep them in jail indefinitely for migrants. Now, while at McBee, Sixkiller also represented Alliant Tech Systems, the largest manufacturer of assault rifles and ammunition in the United States. He also represented a CIA-linked airline, Evergreen International Aviation, which in the 1970s purchased the assets of the old Air America. Since then, Evergreen has coordinated with the CIA to send weapons to the repressive governments of El Salvador and other right-wing dictatorships and to the Contras in the 1980s. And they conducted CIA rendition flights during the Afghanistan and Iraq war, where they flew terrorism suspects to nations that would torture them. So after and to secret black sites. So those were a couple of Sixkiller's big clients when he was at McBee. Now
sounds like an ideal resume for Jenny Durkin.
Yeah. Now, after founding his own consulting firm, Sixkiller Consulting, in 2010, Casey Sixkiller brought along his longtime client, Corrections Corporation of America, even while lobbying on behalf of CoreCivic to keep immigrants in indefinite detention. Sixkiller posed as a critic of the Trump administration's immigration policies, especially the family separation policy. And maybe because CoreCivic wasn't actually in charge of keeping those kids in detention, so they were losing out on the revenue. I'm not sure why. But Sixkiller also brought along Alliant Tech Systems to his own consulting firm. That's the largest manufacturer of assault rifles, where he lobbied against gun safety laws. And Sixkiller Consulting has also represented the oil company Chevron, military contractor DynCorp, and Motorola Solutions in its bid to win Pentagon contracts. Casey's Six Killer took a leave of absence from the firm to work as an aide to Dow Constantine before he was hired by Jenny Durkin as her deputy mayor. But he probably retains at least a financial interest in the firm through his wife, Mariah, who is a partner at the firm. Current clients of Six Killer Consulting include Noble Energy, which is a natural gas exploration and development arm of Chevron, military contractor Textron, Microsoft's defense contracting arm, and the BSA Software Alliance, which was formed by Microsoft to represent the interests of tech companies. Six Killer Consulting has also lobbied the federal government on behalf of King County, which has paid the firm $780,000 between 2011 and 2017, although they did end their contract when Six Killer joined Constantine's staff. So, but there is still the question.
It tells you where Constantine met him.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, I really like this lobbyist. Let's hire him.
Yeah, now, while at McBee, I'm sure Six Killer could see that a lot of the lobbying staff at McBee Consulting, McBee Strategic Consulting, were former legislative aides, and McBee really functions as like a revolving door between the industry lobbying and the federal government, because, you know, if you have a revolving door where you're exchanging personnel all the time, you're having an outsized influence on policy in the federal government. So,
yeah, didn't Six Killer, wasn't he a congressional aide for Jim McDermott and a legislative aide to Patty Murray?
He was early on before he went to D.C. to join the McBee firm. So Six Killer has done the revolving door thing too, to come out of the legislature, go directly into a lobbyist job, go from a lobbyist job right back into working for a government that you've been doing lobbying for. Yeah. And, you know, I'm sure Six Killer Consulting will welcome him back when, when the Durkin administration is over.
Because essentially that's what, when you're in the revolving door, that's the bonus, is you pop over into government, make, influence deals there, change policies, and pick up a ton of contacts that then when you bounce back to the firm, you know, you enlarge on.
You take those contacts with you.
Yeah, and he doesn't have to actually bouncing back to the firm won't be much of a problem since his wife is a partner.
Right.
Exactly. Presumably she'll put in a good word for him.
So yeah, that was
some more election news too. Mm-hmm. I wanted to kind of take a look at the mayoral candidate endorsements. This is the season when the candidates do their best to try to get organizations around the area to endorse them as their choice for mayor. And it's been a little difficult sometimes to distinguish some of the candidates on the issues. So let's take a look at the endorsements list for the five biggest mayoral candidates to see who's been more successful or maybe who just has more contacts. Now, if we take them in order of in alphabetical order, Colleen Echohawk would be first. Her endorsement page features Tim Harris, founder of Real Change Newspaper, Michael Byun, executive director of Asian Consulting and Referral Service, and former state senator John McCoy, who's a prominent member and elder of the Tulalip tribe. She has a lot of individuals endorsing her, but no organizations listed yet. Many of the individuals listed are members of local tribes and people of color. Jessen Farrell, she has as her top endorsements on her endorsements page includes Washington Commissioner of Public Lands Hillary Franz, Dominique Davis, the CEO of Community Passageways, U.S. Representative David Hackney of the new 11th District, her colleague City Council Member Dan Strauss, State Representatives Cindy Ryu and Jerry Pollitt, and State Senator June Robinson, and also environmentalist Brady Walkinshaw and Dennis Hayes of the Bullitt Foundation, who is also the founder of Earth Day. She has no organizational endorsements listed on her website. So you can kind of get a picture there that she really appeals to the upper middle class, wealthy, white, but still liberal constituency in Seattle. Lorena Gonzalez.
And environmental groups.
Mm-hmm. And environmental folks, although she has yet to get donations from environmental groups. So that's kind of interesting. And maybe because of the pandemic lockdown. Now, Lorena Gonzalez, her endorsement page prominently features endorsements from popular Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal and former U.S. Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Julianne Castro. She has a number of organizations endorsing her, including the MLK Labor Council, the Teamsters Local 28, Unite Here Local 8, United Food and Commercial Workers Local 21, and four locals of the Service Employees International Union, 775 Northwest, 1199 Northwest, 925, and Local 6. And she also has the Latino Victory Fund. Also endorsing her are a who's who of progressive female politicians, including State Senator Rebecca Saldana, State Representatives Kirsten Harris-Talley, Liz Berry, and Nicole McCree. And three of her colleagues on the city council, Lisa Herbold, Teresa Mosqueda, and Tammy Morales. In addition, she lists Jorge Barron of the Northwest Immigration Rights Project, Faye Lopez Gaitke, former director of the Community Police Commission, and Rich Stoltz, the executive director of One America. So she's been quite successful at getting organizations, particularly labor, to and other politicians, particularly female politicians that she knows, to endorse her. So she's at the top of the heap here in terms of organizational endorsements. Bruce Harrell, who is the next on my list, he has a who's who of mainstream Democrats, including former Governor Gary Locke, former Mayor Norm Rice, former Mayor Wes Ullman, former City Council Member Tom Rasmussen, former City Council Member Jan Drago, and a few current politicians like State Representative Sharon Tomiko Santos and Cindy Ryu, again, who can't make up her mind between Harrell and Farrell. Maybe she thinks they're the same person. And State Senators Reuven Carlisle, Jamie Peterson, and Jesse Solomon, and Port Commissioner
You know,
Peter
Stein. What may have happened there is that, that, you know, she endorsed Farrell and then Harrell jumped in the race.
And she changed her mind. Yeah, that's a possibility, too. Under the community leaders section of his website, there are a lot of individual names listed, including members of his own family, which I always find kind of laughingly funny. But no actual community organizations have endorsed him yet, which I find very, very interesting since I think he may have the best name recognition in the race. And then finally, Andrew Grant Houston, Ace the Architect, he prominently lists five organizational endorsements on his website, the Young Democrats UW chapter, the Transit Writers Union, the Washington State Stonewall Democrats, the Resident and Fellow Physician Union at the UW, and the Sunrise Movement School Hubs of Washington State. He also has many endorsements from individuals, which are, interestingly, he lists by neighborhood. So not quite sure why he did that, but I think maybe to play up that people from different parts of Seattle, not just from the South End in districts 2 and 3 support him. So that's his list of endorsements so far.
I was really struck. Lurked in a couple of Zoom town halls of Colleen Echohawk this week. And you were correct. She spoke mostly in platitudes and didn't give very few specifics. And the specifics she did give tended to lean toward, well, let's create a commission for that.
Yeah, which to me says she just does not have a lot of knowledge about these issues.
Or is not particularly aware that you know community commissions in the past have been routinely ignored by city government and have not been a good vehicle for getting ideas, you know, either approved by constituents or generated by constituents. Mm-hmm. But what was really interesting to me is that there were very few people on the call both times. It makes me, and I contrast that with an event I sat in on for the, Sawant defense folks a couple of weeks ago, where there were a huge number of people on the call. It makes me think that Echo Hawk doesn't have much of a base at this point. She's been very successful at fundraising. She's been somewhat successful at getting endorsements, but she doesn't seem to have much of a base, and that's mm-hmm. and doesn't necessarily have the best name recognition. Harrell and maybe Farrell are and Gonzalez certainly are ahead of that. So yeah. It makes me wonder how effective she's going to be in the primary. She's got a lot of money to buy media, to buy ads in the next month and a half. I suspect we'll see a lot of direct mailers from her in bright, four color, spreads. But, we'll find out how effective that is for a person that isn't necessarily, got the best name recognition in the city. How effective that is in a citywide race in an off-year election.
Yeah. Now, both Echo Hawk and Houston, Andrew Grant Houston, have reached the upper limit of money that they can collect for a run within the city while still taking democracy vouchers. I think that ceiling is $400,000. Bruce Harrell is approaching that ceiling. He also has an independent election committee, which can allow him or his supporters to collect more money and run more ads. And Lorena Gonzalez
and Harrell will need that, because compared to any of the other candidates, he has a disproportionate number of maximum donors.
Yeah, and then Lorena Gonzalez also announced that she has an independent election committee that has formed that will be taking donations to support her. So it's looking right now like it's coming down to Gonzalez and Harrell as the two, contenders who may make it through. Andrew Grant Houston has pledged not to take use money for independent election from an independent election committee. So he's got kind of the, I think maybe he and Echo Hawk have a high hill to climb if they want to make it through to the finals. Farrell, I just don't feel like she's getting broad support. She's getting support of sort of the white liberal folks, but I don't think her support is broad enough yet. And she certainly, you can kind of see that too in the amount of donations that she's got. She's in fifth place, and she's in a pretty far trailing fifth place. So.
Okay. Anything else on that?
Well, I think next week we can start taking a look a little bit at their policy positions.
Yeah, now that they've had a chance to, in some forums, to display their ignorance or savvy, as the case may be.
Yeah.
Because, early on, they didn't have a lot of policy positions because they hadn't had time to study a lot of the issues.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases.
There's been some time. These five main candidates have been in the race for a while. You notice I didn't include Casey Sixkiller. He's trailing by quite a bit, and I don't think he's going to make up the distance by early August. So when I do look at their policy issues, I'll be considering these top five.
Yep.
All right. Well, I have no doubt that will be fascinating. All right. City Council.
Yeah, City Council. So first I wanted to kind of slip in there that Mayor Durkin did take up, I think it was last week that the city council passed a resolution asking Mayor Durkin and Governor Inslee to extend the eviction moratorium to the end of the year. Mayor Durkin has extended it in Seattle to September 30th. So that
happened yesterday. Yeah,
that happened late yesterday.
Just in time for her Friday newsletter to go out.
Yes. Now, the city council passed some bills this week that I thought were quite important. One was the ARPA funding from the federal government, from the American Rescue Plan Act of 2021, which was passed by the Congress in March, which allocates some of its funding to state and local governments. For Seattle, that amount is $128 million over 2 years. Now, the city council this week passed two bills that would allocate the first chunk of those funds, and it puts it to broadly five categories. The first one is $23.5 million for community recovery. That's primarily funds for businesses. Some will be direct financial aid for technical support, for micro businesses, for arts and cultural businesses and organizations, and some will be for employment programs for BIPOC youth and other folks. The second group is $16 million for community well-being. That's for a number of different things: digital and Wi-Fi access, reopening libraries, early learning programs, expanding child care facilities, and supplementing the wages of child care workers who have been struggling through the COVID lockdown. It's for mental health programs, for meal programs, and assistance to survivors of gender-based violence, and for family assistance programs as well. And then the third batch, the biggest chunk of the funding, $49.2 million, will go for housing and homelessness. It will provide money to homelessness service providers and diversion programs, to permanent supportive housing, non-congregant shelters and services, rapid rehousing programs. It will provide additional money for new tiny house villages that can be added to money that's already in the budget that Mayor Durkin has not spent yet and really needs to spend. It will provide money. The biggest chunk will provide money for acquisition of land for affordable housing projects, future affordable housing projects. And it will also fund a six-month pilot program for people living in RVs. That was, I think, something that Lisa Herbold added in there.
And I should point out that all of these types of programs are serving communities that have been hit very badly by the pandemic, or organizations whose funding has been damaged by the pandemic. So it is congruent with the American Rescue Plan.
Yeah, and the money, really, there aren't any restrictions on what the city can spend the money on, but the city council has said that their priorities include helping the city to reopen, but that as part of that, it includes helping people who have been evicted and are on the street, and helping businesses that are struggling because to get customers in the door because customers may feel that the neighborhood isn't safe because of a big tent encampment or because of graffiti and a lot of homeless people sleeping in doorways on the street, et cetera. So even though the city council, they don't want to call that a quote unquote cleaning up the streets, it really is kind of something that the federal government could accept as a valid reason for spending the funds. So that's kind of why this it's in this bill. But also, I mean, the city city really needs those fundings, and it will provide some rescue for folks who are struggling the most in our city right now.
Yes. Now, presuming Durkin spends it.
Yeah, exactly. Now, the fourth broad category was $7 million for community assistance and programming. That's essentially to clean up parks and restart summer programs in parks and community centers, to reopen wading pools and child care centers based in parks and community spaces, to provide support for artists and food vendors who service parks and community centers, to reactivate the Seattle Center facilities, which the Seattle Center is the one park in the city that has a lot of big facilities that require a lot of maintenance. And those facilities have been closed and unused for a long time, and they will probably need some major maintenance. And to make the Stay Healthy Streets program that closed some streets to car traffic permanent, so that pedestrians and bicyclists can continue to use those Stay Healthy Streets safely. And then the final category is $7.5 million in support for city services and workers. So it isn't just the Seattle Center and community centers that have been closed during the pandemic. It's a lot of city government offices and office buildings. And they will need IT. They will need some new IT infrastructure. They'll need cleaning and reopening, and some of the interior space will need to be reconfigured. And there will probably be some areas that need an upgrade to their air filtration systems because of the COVID pandemic. So that's what that final $7.5 million is for.
So with burn season up. Pretty much upon us. Everybody's going to need to upgrade their air filtration systems.
Yeah. Now, another big bill that passed this week was Lisa Herbold's and Teresa Mosqueda's bill to require businesses who employ independent contractors to give those independent contractors a pre-contract written disclosure of the contract terms, including the scope of work, pay rates, and when they could expect to be paid for their work. Now, some businesses and media groups are saying that the council rushed the bill through without hearing from all the stakeholders. Both the city's Office of Labor Standards and the Labor Standards Advisory Commission wrote letters to Herbold and Mosqueda in early June expressing qualms about the legislation and asking the city council to slow down its process. Their main concerns were four. First, they wanted to see more direct feedback from stakeholders, but they didn't define exactly who they meant by this, since the council did actually take testimony from gig workers and domestic workers and their lobbyists about the bill. My guess is that they meant business leaders. The OLS letter mentions hiring entity concerns, which to me says that you got to hear from employers too.
Amazon.
Yeah. Now, their second concern was that both groups called on the council to make sure that the bill contains a minimum wage or minimum pay guarantee for gig workers. The Labor Standards Advisory Commission says in their letter that it could be problematic for employers to give written contracts to contract workers now that include pay clauses in them that might be lower than any minimum wage or pay law that's passed by the council later and that goes into effect after this law would. And that makes sense, right? But there is an easy way to fix that, and the city council actually did step up and do that, and I'll talk about that in a minute. Now, their third concern, the OLS is worried that small employers might be harmed by the bill, though they didn't say or give an example of why. My particularly sole proprietors, and I just kind of look at that and I go, well, you know, anybody running a business can go online, download a template and plug in details and print out a contract. It's not hard. Okay. So, and then their fourth concern.
Yeah. And sole proprietors is a gray area there between that and gig workers.
Yeah, true. Now, the OLS will be tasked with enforcing the law and educating employers. And this is the big, worry. But the OLS currently doesn't have the budget or staff to do that. So they would need more money and they would need to hire more people. So the city council looked at those four issues and they added amendments to the bill that addressed, I think, every one of them. There were three main changes. They exempted contract workers contract work that is less than $600. So that's going to cut out a lot of sort of having to call somebody to come and quickly repair something, you know, and is not a direct employee. So that I think that cures a lot of that, the issues too with small employers. And two, the city council then said that they would take up a separate bill to set a minimum wage or minimum pay for gig workers. So that's being covered. So they don't have to worry about that being forgotten about or not handled. And three, they extended the date for when this ordinance will go into effect from March of next year to September of next year, which is the date that OLS recommended. And that will give the Office of Labor Standards plenty of time to seek funding in the next budget cycle, and it will allow the council to pass a minimum wage or minimum pay bill that could go into effect before September 30th or at the same time. So that cures their other concern about employers offering contracts with a pay rate that's lower than a minimum wage or minimum pay rate that the council passed.
And it gives time for a next mayor to actually spend the funds.
Yes. So with those recommendations with those amendments in place, the council passed the bill unanimously with no objections.
Wow. Yeah, Alex
Peterson didn't jump in and vote no. That's, okay. No, he didn't. Deborah Juarez didn't make a long speech and then vote no.
Okay.
And Sawant didn't vote no either.
Yeah, which is good. Yeah, Sawant didn't make a long denunciation and vote no. So that was good. Now, the council also passed Andrew Lewis's bill to lift the restrictions on $12 million in funding for emergency homelessness services. I think we talked about this a couple weeks ago. The restrictions required the city to get reimbursed by FEMA for this money spent on services for emergency non-congregate shelters. The Durkin administration, however, refused to even ask for reimbursement, saying that they didn't think those expenses would be reimbursed by FEMA, so why even try? And so the money has just sat unspent for months in the city's funds.
That has pissed a lot of people off.
It has. And last Friday, a group of business leaders and neighborhood associations sent a letter to the council expressing their thanks to Andrew Lewis and the co-sponsors of his bill. And they named them Lorena Gonzalez, Shama Sawant, Teresa Mosqueda, and Tammy Morales for taking leadership on this issue. Now, they were very careful to also thank the mayor, but it was clear that they were happy the council was finally ensuring that that money could get spent. The signers of the letter include John Scholes, who's the CEO of the Downtown Seattle Association, Rachel Smith, who is the president and CEO of the Seattle Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce, and the heads of the neighborhood associations for South Lake Union, Uptown, Denny Triangle, and Pioneer Square. And it's probably the first and only time you will see them thanking Shama Sawant for anything. But it's pretty clear to me that they're very happy with their city council member, Andrew Lewis, if not quite as happy with the mayor. So that's a wrap up of what the city council got into this week.
All right. Sticking with the concept of groups that are unhappy, there could be more, but two local pride groups are not happy with each other.
No, the a group called
we don't recall the exact name, but they represent folks who are members of the Black trans community here in the city of Seattle. They held their own gay pride event in a park, and they advertised it as free to members of the Black trans community. And it was meant to be not just a pride event, but also it was not named a Black Lives Matter event, but it was meant to also celebrate Black pride.
Yeah. And be a safe space for Black gay community members,
which is often
a problem.
Doubly subject to violent treatment by the mainstream, right? If you're both a Black male and you're also trans, it's almost like wearing a target on your back when it comes to some white people. Now,
particular white people in SPD, but yes.
Yeah.
But and, also people in gay clubs, also all sorts of places.
Yeah. And so when they held their event, they made it free to members of the Black trans community, but they charged an entry fee for folks who are not members of the Black trans community, particularly white people. And so that got the organizers of
they framed that as reparations.
Yeah. Which anyone who is an ally of a Black person, not just a Black trans person, can really understand that, and it's probably going to be okay with paying the fee, right? but not if you're an organizer of the larger Pride movement, apparently.
Yeah. They sent a letter to the local NAACP and to the organizers of the event.
And the Seattle Human Rights Commission,
yes, of Seattle, claiming that this was reverse discrimination. Now, reverse discrimination as a phrase has a long history as a code word for we don't like what those uppity black people are doing. And this has caused quite the kerfuffle within the local gay community, which is really unfortunate in the middle of Pride. And you were mentioning that Nikita Oliver's campaign manager is somehow in the middle of this?
I didn't actually mention that, but I believe that's probably true.
Actually, they mentioned the Capitol Hill Pride, the two representatives for Capitol Hill Pride claimed that Nikita's campaign manager was involved in this, but Nikita responded online saying that's completely untrue. That person is...
But Nikita is showing support for the black trans group in all this.
Yes, which is what I would expect.
Yeah, she's saying that she's just not going to take part in the larger Pride group's events because of this issue. And she thinks they really were out of line sending a letter to the Seattle Human Rights Commission.
As somebody who is not only black, but also identifies as, I think genderqueer is how she identifies herself.
Actually, we've been calling her she, and I think she goes by they.
Yeah, she does.
Mm-hmm. They do.
They do, yes.
So, yeah, so the people that have a problem with the event also apparently have a problem with Nikita Oliver, or at least are trying to slime her in the process, which is doubly unfortunate because Oliver's been a pretty good ally in the gay community. And is her, you know, does herself identify as part of that broader community. So, themselves. So,
I think it really points up how a lot of, folks who are white folks or not, people of color or don't identify as people of color as their primary sort of self-identification don't really understand the concept of safe space and the kind of physical violence that trans people and particularly trans people of color undergo on a regular, almost daily basis.
There's a word for this. It's called white privilege.
It is.
And there's a lot of it in the gay community, just as there is in the broader community.
Mm-hmm.
Seattle has got a lot of issues with that as a city, and it's not surprising that the gay community does too. You would hope that, and I think this also points to the fact that the Pride celebrations over the years in Seattle have become progressively less political and more corporatized. And the less political they become, the less open they're going to be to some of these subgroups that are political. I'm thinking particularly of the lesbian march is another example. There are several examples of these subgroups within the Pride community that have felt the need to have their own events because they want not only visibility but their own safe space.
Yeah, and they also want to discuss the intersectionality of things like sexism and genderism or racism. And genderism. They want to kind of point up that, you know, these things all intersect and we don't just not only need our own safe space, we also need people to acknowledge us that we exist and acknowledge our issues.
Yeah. And one of the best ways
to do that is to have your own event
are a black trans person, you are a walking example of intersectionality.
Yeah.
So yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So having these events where people can talk about the issues, network, get to know each other, make connections, and advance their issues and their visibility is just really, really important, in addition to creating a safe space. So the fact that the organizers of the larger gay pride can't really envision why these groups want their own events, I think that's really short-sighted and something that they needed to be challenged on.
And I think, you know, I'm actually kind of glad that they wrote the letter, because a lot of times that skepticism in Seattle is unspoken. And, you know, this brought it out into the open, and now the dialogue is happening and we're talking about it.
Exactly.
And that's important, because that conversation absolutely needs to happen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's move on. We would be derelict in our duties if we didn't talk about the updates with the pandemic.
Oh, no, the pandemic's absolutely over. I saw it on the news.
That must be true.
Yeah. Well, no. We'll talk about that in a second. We did hit another important milestone this week, which is that King County became the first large county in the United States to reach 70% of 16-plus vaccinated. Now, that is not herd immunity. It's not 70% of everybody, because you're not counting kids, right? Including the 12 to 15-year-olds that are now eligible for the vaccine. But King County did hit that milestone before any other large county in the U.S., so we can pat ourselves on the back for that. And the new case numbers are going down in King County. They're down below 100 a day. They were over 400 a day routinely throughout the winter and early spring months. So we're getting progress. We're getting there, but we're not quite there yet. And I know on a really sunny, what is now newly a holiday weekend, you know, people might not want to hear that. They might want to just get out and enjoy the beach or whatever, you know, and enjoy restaurants, et cetera. And you're still doing so at your own risk. You're still doing so, where you need to be wearing a mask if you're indoors, especially.
Outdoors without a mask, you're probably okay if you've been vaccinated and you're fairly certain that any person you're coming in close contact with has been vaccinated. But if you're out in a crowd, wear a mask. And if you're indoors, I still wouldn't eat indoors in a restaurant with other people I don't know. Even as someone who has had, who I think may have had COVID and has been vaccinated, I'm not comfortable yet with community spread still going on.
Yeah, and not only community spread, but we found out this week from both the county and the state that two very serious variants have gotten a foothold in Washington state. The first of those, the Delta, originated in India. That is now up to about 12% of statewide cases, and growing quickly. I think that's going to become the dominant variant in the U.S. fairly quickly. And somewhat uniquely in the United States, a Brazilian variant called the Gamma variant has also gotten a foothold. There have been well over 100 cases in the state so far. And the Gamma variant is of concern because it's not only very transmissible, but it also has had some serious outcomes, and particularly serious outcomes among infants and toddlers, who have been dying at an outsized proportion in Brazil compared to the rest of the world, because of this variant. And nobody understands the mechanism yet. So that's very worrisome, because of course that population can't be vaccinated. And, you know, I think a lot of people have deluded themselves that, well, kids can't get COVID, or if they get COVID, it can't be serious. Well, with this variant in particular, it is serious. So don't get complacent, especially if you're a parent. Don't be complacent about this pandemic. We're not done with it yet. You know, and still take all the precautions that you've been taking. You know, I know it's summer. We're probably in a lull. A lot of epidemiologists are concerned that we're going to see another major wave come fall. That doesn't mean summer's not a danger also. So be very careful.
Like I said earlier, and it's also the beginning of burn season here in the West Coast and here in Washington State. They found another dead murder hornet.
God.
Which I really think is
I was going to say get your air filters out, but that doesn't really help with the murder hornets.
No.
Just got to increase the gauge of the wire mesh on our screen doors for those suckers. Yeah.
We just
right through.
We just need to find something that will eat them.
There you go.
Right?
Yeah. And if you feel like you're living in the middle of a really bad disaster movie, you are.
You are. Yeah. It's called climate change.
Let's move on. We are eating up time this week. Let's move on to, unless you had more on the COVID.
No, let's move on.
Let's move to national. Talk about
that. Although I should mention once again that Durkin did extend the eviction moratorium last night. So that's good news.
Yes.
Let's move on to national and the Affordable Care Act. Who would like to start?
Yeah, the Affordable Care Act survived its third hearing in front of the Supreme Court and challenged by Republican governors. But the Supreme Court upheld the Affordable Care Act by a vote of 7-2 with Justices Samuel Alito and Neil Gorsuch dissenting. Now, the issue is that a 2017 decision by Congress removed the penalty for not buying health insurance. That's the individual insurance mandate. So the Republican governors sued to have the Supreme Court review if the entire law could then be thrown out and declared unconstitutional. But there's an additional question that preempts that question and that has to be decided before the lawsuit could go forward. Did the Republican governors and a couple of individuals who are the plaintiffs are suing to overturn the Affordable Care Act suffer any injuries that would give them a legal standing to sue and have the law overturned? On that question, seven of Supreme Court justices said no. Those Republican governors and individuals had not suffered any injury from the Affordable Care Act, so their case was dismissed by the Supreme Court on those grounds. And the court didn't hear whether or not the Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional or not, which could leave it open for yet another challenge. Now, apparently, Alito and Gorsuch both thought that the passage of the Affordable Care Act in itself was an injury just in itself, maybe, I guess, because it caused some Republicans anguish, I suppose, and that the plaintiffs didn't have to demonstrate any financial or physical injury. So,
yes, but I mean, they can get their heartburn treated because there is health care available.
Yeah, amazing.
And isn't Republican anguish a pre-existing condition?
Yeah. Now, this is the third and what some folks were hoping to be the final lawsuit against the Affordable Care Act. At least that's what we're hearing in the mainstream media, that, oh, the ACA is here to stay. But the Supreme Court didn't rule on whether the ACA was unconstitutional or not.
They really ducked that issue entirely.
Yeah.
By focusing on standing.
Yeah, so I'm sure.
It was interesting that, you know, mm-hmm. three of the conservative justices agreed with the majority decision.
Yeah.
Brett Kavanaugh, Amy Coney Barrett, and Clarence Thomas, amazingly enough.
And it really showed, I think, the weakness of the lawsuit itself. So I'm sure the Republicans are sitting down, scratching their heads, trying to come up with a stronger lawsuit where they can demonstrate standing and also challenge the Affordable Care Act. And we'll see if they come up with something like that in the next year or so.
Given that the organizing principle of the Republican Party right now is fantasy, I don't think they'll be able to do it.
Yeah, we'll see. But I also want to point out, too, that the Trump administration's Department of Justice refused to defend the law in court. And they left it to the attorney generals of Democratic states to do that work, which is why the case is titled California versus Texas. So if you're looking, if you want to look it up and read it.
Okay. All right. Moving on. Jav, you got multiple items here. Starting with South Carolina.
Yeah, well, no, that's Supreme Court. Although it bears some resemblance to South Carolina right now in terms of its jurisprudence. We got a unanimous decision from the Supreme Court on Thursday that a Catholic social services agency in Philadelphia could defy city rules and refuse to work with same-sex couples who apply to take in foster children. So this is yet another example how in the current court, claims of religious liberty are almost always going to win. And that's the polite way to put it. The ruder way to put it is that, it's okay to be a bigot if your imaginary sky friend also shares your bigotry, or you think it does anyway. But this was a very discouraging decision, and it, it kind of undercuts some of the mainstream media narrative of, oh, hey, so this Supreme Court isn't so bad. Yeah, they've had a succession of rulings now in this term that have sided with religious institutions that want to discriminate in one form or another against, unfavored minorities. In this case, LGBTQ, but, there have been others as well. So, very, very discouraging, kind of undercut the good news with the ECA.
Okay. Also, developments regarding the former president of the United States.
I forget his name. He and his company are both in deep trouble legally right now. And we found out from a succession of revelations over the past couple of weeks that the Department of Justice, under the former guy, subpoenaed the metadata of the phone records of both first a succession of reporters at CNN, Washington Post and the New York Times, then a couple of congressional members of the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, who's the chair, and Eric Swalwell, who's who spends a lot of time on media, who is also a very prominent member of that committee. And then lastly, the White House counsel who is working under Trump, Don McGahn, also had his phone records subpoenaed. They were subpoenaed from Apple. Apple complied with the subpoena, unlike the White House itself, which didn't comply with congressional subpoenas. And, now all three two former attorney generals and a deputy attorney general, that being Rod Rosenstein, as well as Sessions and Barr, have all denied that they knew anything about the congressional subpoenas, which under DOJ regulations would have had to be cleared at very high levels. So somebody's lying, because particularly given the way, Barr managed the department, which was very hands-on, and very detail oriented. It is very, very hard to believe. And he also resuscitated this. And this was originally a 2017 investigation of leaks within the Trump administration. And it's very hard to believe that Barr, who resuscitated that investigation, oversaw the investigation of sitting members of Congress, that he would not have known about this. So obviously Congress is upset about this. Other people are upset as well. And there's some legal liability involved in that. We mentioned, I think, a couple weeks ago that Don McGahn had testified before Congress and that, that was an important milestone in terms of finally getting him to comply with a congressional subpoena after 2 years. And there's just been a lot of movement on the various investigations into the Trump Organization and in Donald Trump himself. Now, the two that are getting the most attention are the investigation by the Manhattan DA's office. And I should mention that there is an important primary coming up in New York City this week that and of course the primary is basically the election since Democrats dominate New York City politics. So the primary is not only for a mayoral race that's very crowded that has five or six prominent candidates, but also for the DA because the DA's term is expiring and the incumbent Cy Vance is not running for re-election. So the question will be, will a new DA continue with the investigation in the Trump Organization, maybe intensify that investigation? Will indictments be something that Cy Vance does on his way out the door? It's looking like that investigation may be wrapping up, but it's a very, particularly with the financial crimes involved, a very complex investigation that, you know, the number of potential witnesses is expanding. So, and the number of witnesses have been called in to testify before a grand jury has been expanding. So, that is something to keep an eye on during the summer and, you know, invest in popcorn stock.
All right, only have a few minutes left. If we jump to police-related issues and Portland making news this week.
Portland, a couple important things happened there this week. First was the indictment of a police officer for fourth-degree felony assault for and this was something that other video taken showed very clearly. A photographer, a freelance photographer, was at a protest in Portland last summer and was literally hit on the back of the head with a baton by an officer. And she was clearly marked as press at the time. If you see the video, and it's all over social media, you'll see what I mean. And then continued to strike her once she was down on the ground. Fortunately, she was not seriously injured. She had already settled with the city of Portland for $50,000 for a lawsuit that she had filed against the city. And this week, the officer who was responsible for that was indicted for, as I say, fourth-degree felony assault. Now, the Rapid Response Team, which is the section of the Portland Police Bureau that was policing protests, it's about 50 officers, and they all resigned en masse to protest the indictment of this officer. They apparently didn't like the idea that they might be held accountable for their actions last year, because it wasn't just that one officer who was caught on video doing things that, you know, if anyone else had done them, would be considered illegal, and probably should be considered illegal when they did them, too. They were very aggressive and very violent. The running joke, because I shared the live stream of a lot of these protests last year, and the running joke was, you know, the nightly police riot, because it really was. You know, now we see that the police officers, you know, really don't like being held accountable for their actions during those protests. And, of course, those protests are ongoing in Portland and elsewhere. And I expect we'll see more of them this summer. So,
and just to clarify, they resigned from being on that particular team. They are still all employed at Portland.
That is correct. They are all still sworn police officers, which is unfortunate. You know, so Portland Police Bureau now has to figure out who's going to police protests. And that may be a mixed bag, because it may be the officers that they draw onto that team, you know, don't have, you know, innate hostility toward protesters. But at the same time, and aren't as averse to accountability, but at the same time, they're not necessarily trained in crowd control. So, you know, it's kind of,
I think this has been an issue in most police departments. Who on the force is trained in crowd control? Hardly anyone.
And how are they being trained? Because
the use
of force standards have been hugely controversial in SPD and in a lot of places around the country.
Yeah. Unfortunately, with that, we're out of time. We're going to have to leave it there and return to this subject.
Yes, there's lots more cops behaving badly than I haven't gotten to. So, and I really would like to get to that next week, because, you know, it's become so routine, and mass shootings have become so routine that they hardly make the news anymore. So people haven't heard about a lot of this stuff. So, and people should, because it should be national news. It should be controversial and consequential.
All right. All right. Well, we will talk with you both same time next week.
We will be here.
I'll be here.